Hello and welcome to New Books in Education. I'm Trevor Matea, one of your hosts on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Roy F. Fox about his book, Facing the Sky, Composing Through Trauma in Word and Image. Roy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Trevor. It's my pleasure.
Roy, it's great to have you here, and I'm wondering if we could begin the interview by having you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I have been a high school teacher, a university faculty member for the last 25 years. Before that, I did a number of jobs, a ditch digger, an all-night cook, plastics factory, God help me, a number of things like that. I officially retired last August, but I'm still have my hand in a number of projects. I was an art major as an undergraduate and shifted into English, and so I have been teaching writing and literature and language. I'm currently teaching an online course in the teaching of language. I've been very fortunate to have my hands in a lot of different but related areas.
Can you tell us a little bit about this book, Facing the Sky, and how you came to write this one?
Yes, a lot of personal and professional reasons. And I'm going to kind of go through these a little bit randomly.
Sure.
But first, you know, people have to understand that, you know, it's not a new thing. A lot of perceptive, smart people in the past have used writing in order to solve problems and work their way through trauma. And when I say trauma, I'm talking a whole continuum of traumas, from things that we might consider relatively minor to, you know, sudden tragedy that just throws people into the Thomas Jefferson, for example, in Fawn Brody's book, has a letters that he wrote to Maria Cosway, a woman that he fell in love with when he was in France. And it's called A Dialogue Between My Head and My Heart. And that's exactly what it is. And that's a core of writing about trauma, is that, you know, you have to draw upon rationality and logic, as well as emotions and intuition and all of those things. Abraham Lincoln, another example, a few years ago, an historian, Richard L. Miller, discovered what's been called Lincoln's suicide poem. And, you know, most historians agree that it was Lincoln's that he wrote when he was living in Illinois. A slightly more recent example is Harry Truman, President Truman, who would lock himself into a room at the Muehlbach Hotel in Kansas City when he was a judge, when he was a senator, and later in the White House. But he would go in and write his way out of what was bothering him. So there's definite precedence. Other reasons, I've spent my life in the teaching of writing and the teaching of teachers about writing, and I've done other research on writing. I am very much a believer in imagery, whether it's internal in our heads or external in a painting or a film that we're watching. I've worked in media literacy for a long time, helping to get it into the national standards. And there's some reasons about the status quo that still exists that also motivated me to do this book. And that one of the main ones is that, by and large, especially in the middle and upper grades in public school and in an awful lot of universities, what is called personal writing is pretty much banned. you know, we have a caste system in society, but we've got one in terms of discourse in schools. And the thought is that argumentation and academic writing is more pure than writing about personal experience. But there's no biological proof, there's no academic or pedagogical reasons that that should be excluded, other than the business model that has shaped education, at least since the 1980s. There are lots of stereotypes that surround personal writing, this fear that it's going to pollute the more pure forms of discourse, such as argumentation. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a bit of unawareness in the public that many of our best writers do indeed integrate personal experience into more objective forms of writing, whether it's George Orwell or Mark Twain or Joan Didion or E.B. White or Martin Luther King. You know, I mean, you don't have to look too far. In the way that rural and urban English has been stigmatized as being ungrammatical and sloppy and ignorant, that has helped sweep the value of personal writing away. Because, I mean, by the same token, those are deemed, by and large, impure and pollutants of a more pure English or pure academic thinking. And I just don't believe in that kind of purity at all. There's no evidence for it. One irony here is that we hear teachers and administrators and everybody else always say, well, we teach individuals. We don't treat everybody the same. We focus on the individual. And my answer to that is no, we don't. The only way we can teach individuals is to find out about them and find out and help them bring to the surface what's going on in their heads when they come into school. And we simply don't do that. That is largely a taboo. A student in my course on writing about trauma really took it to heart, and she taught that way in junior high for several years, and she could not stop her students from writing, and she just did great with it. And I will come back to her, or help me remember to come back to her. The most important reason for doing the book was the people that I worked with. My students and students of students and colleagues and friends who are writers, people I met at conferences, principals. And I decided to focus on how language experts, people with master's and doctoral students, but I also do middle school and a few, some junior high students and high school students, but how do they go about it? We needed to learn about not just how novices did it, but how experts did it. And so that was a main reason. There is a chapter on Lucy, and that is her real name. She's the only person who wanted, you know, her real name, Hughes. Mm-hmm. Who's a faculty member. Kate is a faculty member. Claire in the book, who appears in each chapter, that's the student that I had in class who went on to become a teacher. Cass is a middle school student using imagery and writing. Khan is a Vietnamese college student who used imagery and writing. Juan is a middle school boy, used imagery and writing. But overall, what I wanted to do was try to demystify the inner workings of language and imagery to show how it addressed issues of trauma. And there are varying levels of trauma. The two major case studies are serious pieces of trauma. Lucy had a stage 4 metastatic cancer diagnosis, and she had been my student several years ago. And I very cautiously asked her, you know, would you work with me? I'm working on this book now. And she just readily agreed, and she was wonderful. There are a number of other people who just have very different stories, but I think I better stop there and let you get on.
One thing I appreciate about the book is that you share a little bit about your own traumas that you've experienced. In fact, you begin the book by sharing an experience of yours as a young boy, and that was how you dealt with the loss of your grandfather. And you're not only telling your readers that, you know, at that time you weren't composing words and images to ease your pain, but you're reminding us that many of the means of communication that you share with students in your graduate course, those were just not available to you in 1959. So I guess I'm wondering, when did you discover that people could be using composition to help themselves through the grieving process?
Well, it was, I love the question. It was a slow process. Where I start the book at age 9 or 10, I was like a kid, I want to say, but who just didn't know and was only responding to what was there. But I was also responding to what was not there. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things I couldn't understand, was why isn't this being acknowledged? Why are we pretending so much? And of course, and I'm talking about my family, my immediate family and so forth, right after the death of my grandfather at his house. There was the stiff upper lip of the Midwest in the 1950s, and that's still true, and there's a lot of value and a lot of virtue in that. I don't dismiss that, but as a kid, it was unfathomable. I came to understand in the middle of my career, early in my career in teaching writing, that students would give me writing about trauma whether I asked for it or not. In other words, they would often reinterpret, reshape a writing assignment or ignore the writing assignment because they had to deal with what was sitting on their head or sitting on their heart before they could do anything else. And that's a compelling reason to deal with this, or to offer to deal with it and face it head on, because it affects, it becomes a filter through everything that they're trying to learn and everything that we might be trying to teach. So, I would get it whether I wanted it or not. I gradually kept, making academic assignments that legitimized parts of a personal trauma or parts of personal experience. And a number of learning psychologists from Louise Rosenblatt to Vygotsky to Jerome Bruner, and on and on, will tell us that it has to make new material, new information, has to make sense within the personal context. So I gradually became aware, or relatively quickly became aware, that that's part of it, and it should be legitimized as much as it's not. So that was the language end. It was much more recently that I, after I had been teaching graduate courses in for teachers on how to deal with trauma through writing in the classroom or in a professional context, that it dawned on me through my work in media literacy and through my previous experience as an art teacher that, oh, you know, these two go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. It's much more combustible if there's visual and verbal material to work with. It's much more combustible. And so then I offered the course with both. And I was, even I was surprised at what people did and how the visual, or unpacking and interrogating a visual, as well as unpacking and interrogating language, I was surprised at how effective that was. And so there's one chapter that deals with seven writers composing through word and image. And I show the imagery that they sometimes created themselves. They sometimes generated electronically on a computer or whatever, and some of the process that they went through and how it helped them. One of the last times I taught this course, Khan is a brilliant Vietnamese graduate student of mine. And during that course, his good friend was dying of cancer. It just happened that way. And so his friend became the focus of the writing that he did over that semester. And he did some very interesting, beautiful work.
You mentioned earlier, even before you were teaching this course, you were identifying trauma in your students' writing that was seemingly about something unrelated. I was wondering, what were those characteristics of the writing that you found? What sort of ties all this writing together and maybe makes it unique from writing that people do when they're experiencing joy or not in the midst of a traumatic experience or one that they're dealing with?
Yes. One of the things I noticed was that when they hit upon these kind of personal, meaningful topics, they would write a lot more. They would become much more fluent. A lot of times, their style would become much clearer and much more fluent and articulate. It would also become more detailed. The voice or persona in the writing would become more natural, smoother, versus some tortured syntax that they might get involved in writing about something that they were less familiar with. Now, there is great value in writing, and I'm a deep believer in writing about things that you are not familiar with. One of the misperceptions, and forgive me if I wander here a bit, but one misperception is that such writing is not objective. Well, I would request objective writing about personal experience and trauma, and I would request much more subjective about the same topic. Mm-hmm. Another key component in writing about trauma, but that is much more common in academia and public schools is research writing. Well, research writing and using secondary sources has plays a key role in writing about trauma to help people enlarge the context, because they're living their lives thinking, oh, this only affects me. You know, I'm suffering here by myself. And so that's when I steer them toward the larger world, the larger context, and secondary sources. I'll give an example or two. One of my students was writing about an instance when his younger brother was arrested for using drugs. They lived in a small Midwestern town, and his mother comes in to the room where my student was and asks him if he knew about it, his brother using drugs, and he said no. But he lied, and that was nagging at him. And the fact that this family member in this small conservative farming community was arrested was a big deal, and traumatizing for them, and especially traumatizing for the writer because of the lie he had told. Well, one of the things, we got to the point where what he needed to do was look at different and larger contexts. And it got to the point where I had to say, you know, Rob, or whatever his name was, this would not be such a big deal in anybody's mind in Eugene, Oregon, mm-hmm. or Seattle, Washington, or, you know. So the idea was to get him to research practices and attitudes in a larger context in other places. You know, one student was, her relatively mild trauma was not understanding her birth, where she came from. She was adopted by a great family. She loved her adopted parents, but she just didn't know why she had been abandoned. And so what she did was research why people put children up for adoption in rural Kansas in the 1970s, you know, that kind of thing. The reasons for it, the stats behind it, what happened to the parents, why they would do so, those kinds of things. So secondary sources can and should play a key role. Some other things that set the writing off. Let me go back to the audience awareness, and I mentioned fluency or writing more and writing more naturally. But what often happens is that in writing about trauma, writers they need to be aware of audience, yes, but to a large extent, they need to turn that awareness off or dial it down. Because if they're too obsessed and too aware of somebody sitting on their shoulder, they get hamstrung, they get blocked, they start trying to please a reader, and that's not what early stages of this is about. Another thing that clued me in to differences in writing about trauma versus other kinds of writing was what James Moffat called simultaneous differentiation and integration. And when somebody is you know, wrestling with a trauma, you see them dealing with oppositions and tugging one way and tugging another. And that's a very good thing. but because what they're trying to do in simple terms is to figure out, well, how am I like other people and how am I different from other people? And that's a key question that they're wanting to sort out. So that shows up. When they're probing and interrogating and tolerating ambiguity and oppositions, that's a good thing also. But what typically happens if people believe they don't have the right to do that is that they just stop. They say, oh, these are opposites. Okay, I'm at the end of the road. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not it. You're at the beginning of the road, and you've got to keep going. Imagery is a big thing. External, pictorial, yes, but internal imagery in reading and writing is key. And I've spent a lifetime trying to get teachers to accept that and to understand it and to explore it. But in an academic setting, I have always been surprised at how everybody else thinks that imagery is taboo. You know, like when I taught developmental writing students or high school teachers or whatever, they think that their writing has to be academic, polysyllabic, long sentences, academic jargony, all of those things that are terrible, you know, for thinking and for style. But that's what they think academic and school writing should be. Mm-hmm. And so they just put themselves in knots if they believe in that. When I would teach very novice writers who could not get into the standard freshman writing course, I would have them deconstruct and interrogate and try to legitimize images in their head. I would have them write about dreams. I would have them write about half-formed thoughts that were partially imagistic. And I got great writing. And the thing is, most students in any kind of school environment simply think it's taboo. They simply don't trust it. They simply think that teachers do not want anything that might be concrete or pictorial or detailed. So, you know, lots of other reasons. I will come back to some of them maybe later.
You just hit on something else that I'm really interested in is, while, you know, you can cite historical examples from Jefferson to Harry Truman, it's not something, this type of writing isn't commonplace in high schools. It doesn't seem like there are a lot of courses like this in college or in graduate school either. And so how did you go about legitimizing this style of, or this purpose for writing amongst your faculty and your students? How did you change their minds and to get them to see it differently?
Wonderful question. With some trepidation, mm-hmm. When I legitimized the whole thing and gave it as a title to a course, you know, I thought, well, you know, I must have colleagues who think I'm in deep space. You know, they must think I'm Shirley MacLaine out on a limb, and on and on and on. My students jumped right in, bless their hearts. They hardly, and it's not for everyone all the time, and some of them question it, and some of them were reluctant, yes, but they were won over. So because this was started as a course for teachers, I had to legitimize and have background readings and discussions and writings about research on imagery and psycholinguistic research on imagery. Alan Pavio and Stephen Koslin and a number of other psycholinguists focus on this, and they will reduce, and some of it is reductionist, but they will reduce imagery to kind of labeled elements like imagens and logogens, word and image, and arrive at the conclusion that, well, they reinforce each other, that an image can elicit words, but it can also elicit other images, and an image can evoke another image, but also evoke words. So when you put the two together, they really are, I think, much more combustible. My students, and in particular, and surprisingly to me, my international students grabbed onto it more quickly and tighter and more thoroughly than my native-born speakers. And so that was a surprise to me. And the only explanation I have for that is that because they know more than one language, they have had experience and more trust in matching verbal language and thought with images and pictures and all that kind of thing. They were much more receptive, a lot faster, I think, than my native-born speakers.
I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more to the physical and emotional benefits of writing or composing art pieces through trauma.
Yes, yes. Number one, it's not for everybody, and it's not for everybody all the time. I in essence got away with this course because I could. I was a full rank, or at the time, professor level, and I had tenure, and I had tenure in another English department. And I could do it. I sound like Bill Clinton, I did it because I could. And there was not a questioning about that. I think I did more questioning of myself, because I would have some students who, just a few out of the first time I taught it, out of 20 some, I had maybe two to three maybe, who were somewhat resistant, and they would dodge around the issues, or they would write in circles to avoid nailing the issue. And there's a point in the process where I want people to nail it on the head and say it in very explicit terms. And the most pushy thing I do at that point with a reluctant writer is to give them a sentence pattern. If they've been writing it in circles and avoiding issues, I would give them a pattern that says, I am writing about blank, fill in the issue, for these three reasons, reason number one, reason number two, reason number three. But that's rare. Some people, a very, very few, at least in my experience, and Claire in the book is one of them. And so let me tell you just a little bit about Claire. Caused me to question myself and the whole concept. She would do, she was an articulate, smart, young woman, graduate teacher, graduate student. And she would do certain assignments, but the final assignment would ask them to put all these different experiences that they wrote about together and to connect them in certain ways. And she persisted in saying, I just don't have anything to write about. And as I say, in that course, there was a lot of apparatus or a lot of supplementary material about the legitimacy of vocalizing or displaying, it's not the right word, but of articulating trauma and psychological reasons for it and how it works and that kind of thing. But she just kept saying, I can't do it. I don't have anything. Even though I would constantly say, you know, trauma is very different for each person. And I can't judge the trauma. For some people, you're going to be down here on the continuum where it's no big deal, it's no big whoop, or it might be in the middle, or it might be a very serious trauma. In the book, two of the case studies they're very serious. One was, as I said, the stage 4 cancer diagnosis and metastatic cancer. Such a diagnosis is a death sentence. And because of that, no money is put into research, or very little money put into research for it. The other case study, her husband was killed in a freak accident, you know, when a deer jumped in front of his motorcycle, kind of thing. And these are people who were just cast into deep space and chaos, and it was like they woke up in a different world and had to start forming connections and relationships and identities all over again, even in their 40s and 50s. To go back to Claire, mm-hmm. She kept saying, the student who could not find anything traumatic to write about, despite all of that, the course ended. I had to give her an incomplete. And so I started thinking, you know, she can't be alone. There have to be other people who just for one reason or another can't or won't approach any trauma, regardless of how loosely that term is used. So I gave her an incomplete and really finally forgot about it, stopped questioning myself. You know, I got busy with other things. You know how that goes. You got to keep going. Months later, she writes me and she said, you know, dear Dr. Fox, my name is the last thing you probably want to read, but I want to tell you that I finally wrote this and it's attached to this email. And, you know, it was very difficult, et cetera, et cetera. Well, after the course, she went to a counselor and then wrote this beautiful, long, detailed account of her being raped by her stepbrother when she was growing up. And then she eventually found out that her stepbrother had raped her sister and her other sister. Okay. And that was, she just couldn't deal with it at that time. Mm-hmm. So number one, it's not for everyone. Number two, you know, if it's a course, you know, it happens at a snapshot in time and you don't know where people are and maybe they can't do it. But back to Claire became such a convert. She started allowing her junior high students to write about trauma all the time. And she did that for several years. And students came in and they just wrote their hearts out and their eyes out all the time. I mean, they were just doing incredible amounts, of production. I'm sure quality stuff. But then one day, you know, as you might expect, it became a bit of a bureaucratic issue when a counselor or administrator somehow found out that one student in her journal or whatever it was had thought about suicide, but my student, Claire, the teacher, had not read that. In other words, she told her students, if you've got something you're writing in your journal you don't want me to read, just fold the page over, you know, and I'm busy enough, I won't read it. So she didn't read that. Anyway, principal finds out, and it kind of blew things up. And she went back to teaching a more traditional approach and didn't like it. And so she, and this is a bittersweet thing, she stopped being an English teacher and went back to school to become a counselor where she could use writing. So she's an interesting case that appears all the way through the book. So, yeah, it's not for everyone. Most people who I've worked with, sometimes, a lot of times they volunteer. They come to me. If it's imposed, you have to be careful. And one thing that I always did, at least in my college classes, was that I would have a counseling psychologist on call. And I would tell them ahead of time, I said, I don't expect to need you, but it's always possible. And sometimes they would come to the class once and introduce themselves and say, I'm here. And, you know, so that's a safety net, because teachers are not psychologists, but in a way they are, much more than people realize, because when students have problems, they have to be dealt with right then, right there. You can't say, oh, let me go consult my psychologist or my counselor. I mean, sometimes you can, but an awful lot of, it's like baseball, an awful lot of decisions are made in the heat of battle, to mix a metaphor.
Roy, we've taken up a lot of your time, and so I'm just going to ask you one more question, and that is, how can we follow your work now?
The book is a good place to start. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a couple of ideas. I will eventually have a website, or a better website, I should say. What I have now is just a university thing. In the fall of this year, I was fortunate enough to be a Fulbright scholar in Ireland, at a university in Ireland, and it's part teaching and part research. And I'll be working with faculty members who want to improve the quantity and quality of their professional products, whether it's writing or whether it's art or whether it's sculpture or a musical composition or whatever it is. One of the ways I'll be doing that is through the door of imagery and visual and verbal thinking. And that's what they wanted. A portion of my work in Cork, Ireland, will also be research-based, and trauma is not a key element, but it will certainly play in, because they will be developing projects in their own disciplines, whether it's art or music or social sciences or whatever it is. And I will want them to, or hope that they choose projects that are personally meaningful for them. And so when that happens, you get into, the creator gets into themes of resistance to the status quo. They get into themes of personal identity. They get into themes of agency, all those kinds of good things. So my research will be kind of mapping their process in coming up with meaningful projects. And in terms of identity and personal experience, it's really hard to bypass traumatic experience in that. So I look forward to writing about that work next year in some shape or form. I edit a little journal called Engaging Cultures and Voices, Learning Through Media. And it's free. It's open access. We do a lot of stuff for, you know, speakers of other languages and teachers who work with English language learners. But it's certainly not limited to that. But it has a strong media and imagery focus to learning language. So those are probably the best ways right now.
Roy, those sound like fantastic projects, and congratulations on your Fulbright. I enjoyed having you on the show today.
It was my pleasure, Trevor, and it's always a gift, you know, to have a conversation with somebody who has read the book and knows what they're talking about and is interested. So I appreciate it on my end just as much.
Excellent. So much. Thank you. Take care.
Take care. You too.